Welcome to Signs of Life, exploring survival of consciousness, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation on the web at www.foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
I can feel you like an ocean that won't seem to let me go.
Hello and blessings to all. Welcome to Signs of Life, brought to you by Forever Family Foundation with our host, Bob Ginsberg. I'm Fran Ginsberg, and our show tonight is sponsored by Starseed Gems. They are the proud sponsors of the 8th Annual Original Afterlife Conference this year in Durham, North Carolina, November 8th and 9th, and they can be found on the web at starseedgems.com. Our guest tonight is Dr. Carlos Alvarado, and if you have a question, comment, or would like to talk to our guest, the toll-free number here is 888-627-6008. So, Bob, what's up today?
Oh, not much. You know, I was, I noticed in the, all over the web during the week, or was it last week, I forget, there was more celebrities that came out talking about psychic ability and ability
Amazing.
To see the dead, right? This time it was Goldie Hawn and her daughter, both, and Kate Hudson, who gave an interview, and they both talked about having intuitive abilities and seeing the dead on a regular basis.
Them and everybody else.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, it was a time when that would have been...
political suicide.
Yeah, yeah, well, actor suicide, right?
They're, celebrity suicide. They're,
yeah, they're, yeah, they're agents. And, you know, but now it seems like, you know...
Yeah, I mean, look what happened with... now I can't remember her name. Wow, I just went, I can see her. Shirley MacLaine.
Oh, Shirley MacLaine.
Shirley MacLaine.
Yeah.
She was the pioneer of talking about this stuff as a celebrity, and you're exactly right. She.
Yeah, but what's interesting, though, is that, you know, now she's, you know, accepted again.
Oh,
you know,
miraculously.
Yeah, I mean, come full circle, and now she's, you know, starring in a lot of things, you know, once again, and... as this stuff becomes, you know, more and more mainstream, you know, so to speak. But I wonder what motivates, you know, people like that. You know, sometimes,
money.
Yeah, well, sometimes, sometimes you're a little suspicious. Are they doing this just for publicity,
of
you know,
course.
When their career hits a little low, you know, or, you know, maybe their motives are pure, you know, and they really like to
are they going to totally give up acting and use all of their...
No, but just to spread the word, like we're always talking about, and people sharing experiences.
Yeah, but spreading the word then would, they would avail themselves to organizations like ours that are not-for-profit that are working really hard to change worldview, but they're not. They're getting...
I haven't called.
Well, they're all over the web saying, oh, look what I can do, look what I can do, which
right.
is what we see everybody suddenly realizing that they have all of these inner abilities, not realizing that we're all hardwired with it and we were born with this stuff. We just kind of pushed it aside because we live in this very materialistic world. So... Now that it's become popular because of some TV shows, now everybody's coming out from the woodwork and saying, oh, I can do this, I can do it, like they're the only one. But everybody can do it, and if you can't do it, you certainly can learn how to do it because it's within you.
Yeah, well, I appreciate when high-profile people come out talking about this, you know, I give them the benefit of the doubt, and it's good for...
You're a better man than I am.
Yeah, well... difference of opinion there. There was an article just before we came on air that I saw actually on Facebook. I think it was posted by Julia Asante, but it was an article that somebody else had written and forwarded to her. It's about a prison in Angola, of all places, a very large prison with something like 6,000 inmates, and you could imagine the conditions are not probably not the best. And when you have a prison population that size, you're going to have a lot of illness and death. So what they decided to do was to train volunteer inmates in hospice work. And these inmates take care of their fellow, you know, prisoners, you know, that are in the dying process. And lo and behold, when they started interviewing all of these inmate volunteers, 26 out of 29 volunteers reported that their patients had deathbed visions, reported deathbed visions. And what was interesting is that it had an effect on the entire prison population, you know, once, you know, word was spread around. And they said, I was reading, the program has transformed one of the most violent penitentiaries into the least violent maximum security prison. Well, this is in the U.S., but I don't know, obviously Angola is not in the U.S., but it says the frequency that the criminal lifers experience the promise of ineffable love, beauty, and forgiveness to come as they draw their last breath. So it started to catch on, and the prison started to take on more of a spiritual tone. So it's pretty interesting, don't you think?
So then we go back to the can we change world behavior by changing worldview?
Yeah, I think so. You know, that raises another question, is that, which I think about often. Do you think it's important for people to reach some sort of a personal conclusion about either life continues on or it doesn't? In other words, is it healthy to be in that middle ground? I mean, you know, I sort of look at there's a big middle class, so to speak, when it comes to an afterlife belief. You have the people that fervently believe that we survive, and on the other side, people who adamantly insist that we don't. You know, the question is, you know, do they each live their lives differently? And what about all the people in the middle? Do you think that they could gain or live a more productive and meaningful life if they had, you know, reached the conclusion that they did survive?
I think if both of those groups, the bottom group and the middle group, would experience a transformation, if they would open themselves up to the possibility that we do survive a physical death. And for those who do believe, who have had some sort of a personal experience that helped them to believe, and even the ones that didn't who do believe, they already are living different, more loving-oriented lives. And we need those other two groups to catch up with everybody.
Yeah. Well, the people, especially the people that are on the fence, I mean, a lot of times they're conflicted. You know, they have emotional issues. They have feelings, feelings of being unsatisfied or unfulfilled because they have this hope, and the hope may be based on a lot of things, including, you know, religious beliefs, but they don't really have any concrete evidence. So they're sort of like floating between, you know, each way. So that's one of the reasons we hope that people start sharing all these experiences so people can, you know, move away from that hope into some concrete knowing. And like you said, if you do believe that you're going to survive, that you will, especially if the life in this other world is dependent upon the way you lived here, you're going to change the way you live here, right?
Right. And also just take also into consideration that these inmates that were the hospice leaders and the inmates who were crossing over, that they had that experience with them. So even though they didn't have a firsthand afterlife experience, they were able to witness somebody having a firsthand afterlife experience. And that's really that all it takes.
Right.
So just imagine if everybody would just step back, and when somebody's ill, and we all know somebody who's ill now and then, who's going to cross over, spend some time with them. You know, watch them, listen to them, listen to what they have to say, listen to their experiences, and live the day with them. And you too will become a more open, loving person, and we will be able to change worldview.
Well, I can't argue with that. We're going to go to a break because when we come back, we're going to have Dr. Alvarado, who's an expert on some of the things that we're talking about, including deathbed vision. So stay with us, and we'll be back in a few.
Starseed Gems Studios in Cocoa, Florida, fuses cremation ashes within art glass, making beautiful stones. The ashes are visible in the darkness and resemble a beautiful night sky. Starseed Gems, developed by the parents of a young man who passed away, are set in hand-sculpted silver and gold settings. Prices start at $150. Visit www.starseedgems.com or call 321-632-7770. That's www.starseedgems.com or 321-632-7770.
When grieving the loss of a loved one, sometimes a hug is just what you need. Hugs from Heaven are lightly weighted shoulder wraps that are made from the fabric of your loved one's clothing. Your clothing can also be made into memory pillows and sachets. Each Hugs from Heaven is handmade with loving care and is as unique as your loved one's spirit. Visit us at hugsfromheaven.com. That's Hugs, spelled with a Z, from heaven.com. Who couldn't use a hug?
Perhaps you have heard that there is scientific evidence of an afterlife, but you are confused. Plan to attend a landmark convention in Durham, North Carolina, November 8th and 9th, and let's clear up that confusion. Let an esteemed group of scientists from prestigious universities and institutions show you the way. This will be a gathering of the top organizations that have been researching afterlife evidence for decades, all coming together for the first time. Whether you want to learn about reincarnation, mediumship, apparitions, deathbed visions, near-death experiences, or phone calls from the dead, this is the place to be. The weekend will also include demonstrations of spirit communication by Forever Family Foundation certified mediums. Click on the events page at our website, foreverfamilyfoundation.org, to learn more about the conference weekend and the many additional events before and after the conference. Or call 631-425-7707 for more information.
I would like to introduce you to the Forever Family Foundation, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to provide a forum where individuals and families who have suffered the loss of a loved one can turn for support, information, and hope. We believe in the continuity of the family, even though a member has left the physical world. The Forever Family Foundation is a joint effort of scientists, research mediums, and interested people who support the premise that life does not end with physical death. We wish to prove that the bond of the family cannot be broken, even by death. We invite anyone who's trying to cope with the loss of a loved one to contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707. That's 631-425-7707. Or you can find us on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
Welcome back to Signs of Life, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation.
For those just tuning in, our guest tonight is Dr. Carlos Alvarado. Our sponsor is Starseed Gems. They are the proud sponsors of the 8th Annual Original Afterlife Conference this November 8th and 9th in Durham, North Carolina. And they can be found on the web at starseedgems.com. Bob?
And Dr. Carlos Alvarado, he's enjoyed a long career in parapsychology. He's been associated with many of the most prestigious institutions in the field. He received his doctorate in psychology from the University of Edinburgh. His work is centered on survey research and on out-of-body experiences and other psychic experiences. He has an impressive resume, which includes positions at the Rhine Research Center, the Kessler Parapsychology Unit in the Department of Psychology at the University of Edinburgh, the Parapsychology Foundation, Sophia University, Division of Perceptual Studies in the Department of Psychiatry and Neurobehavioral Sciences at the University of Virginia. He's taught over the years parapsychology classes at universities and colleges. He's widely recognized as a scholar of the history of parapsychology, and his scholarly work has been published in psychology, psychiatry, and parapsychology journals. And also, last but not least, he's a member of Forever Family Foundation's Scientific Advisory Board. You can learn more on the website, theazire.org. That's theazire.org. Welcome to the show, Carlos.
Well, thank you. It's nice to be back.
Yeah, it's nice to have you back. You know, so I mentioned that it's very well known that you are a scholar in the history of psychical research. So I always wonder, you know, what attracts you to the history? Is it because you feel that we have much to learn from these investigators and mediums of the past?
Yes, actually, I feel that there is a lot to learn from the past. From one, there is a lot of evidence for phenomena that sometimes is not studied today, at least not very frequently. And there are also ideas that we can get about actual topics of research, you know, things to do with the study of mediumship. A lot of the more detailed reports of studies with mediums come from the old days, and by that I mean, you know, before 1930. And I think that being acquainted with a lot of literature is very helpful for current researchers. I'm also interested in all that material from a whole different point of view, which is more the purely historical. By that I mean that I'm also interested not only in evidential things, but in the whole issue of the social and cultural context in which mediumship and many other phenomena took place in the old days. So I like to study and document how people thought about specific phenomena at certain time periods, even if those ideas are not very current today. You know, there are many ideas that are abandoned in science and in any other discipline through time. Many ideas come and go, and we tend sometimes not to pay attention to the old materials that are about ideas that are not current today. But I think it's important to do that because that tells us a lot about the development of the science at that particular time period. We are today you know, we are made, our field is made today from all the things that happened in the past, not only the things that were successful or that are still current today. So I'm very interested in documenting all that social aspect of science as well.
Yeah, and I know you do an excellent job. You know, talking about the mediumship, especially, you know, going back to the late 1800s, sometimes when I have the luxury of time, I'll pick up a book from the late 1800s that discuss mediumship and survival. And, you know, the concepts have different terms, but I think that we're talking about the same thing that current-day researchers talk about. I mean, I'm reading I read a book recently where they were talking about animal magnetism. You know, I looked at that term and I said, "What the hell is animal magnetism?" You know, or they talk of mesmerism, aren't these just other terms for, you know, clairvoyance and this vitality of energy from unseen forces?
We have so many different terms. I think the concepts still remain similar. The whole concept of animal magnetism, when it was first introduced, was kind of a universal force that permeated, you know, everything, but could also be used. It could be channeled to induce healing or to induce phenomena such as telepathy, clairvoyance, and many other things. But it was basically an idea of a biophysical type force that was inside the nervous system as well as in nature and could be used to induce phenomena. We still have that same concept. You know, people talk about bioenergy, biofields, or, you know, so many other terms. And in reality, we're still dealing, I think, with the same basic concept. It's just that it has different names, and sometimes we get disconnected because the terminology is very different.
Yeah. Well, when we, again, on the topic of these, some of the, I know you've written extensively about some of these extraordinary mediums, and many of them were assisted by intermediaries, you know, that they called controls, you know, that helped them in the process of spirit communication. And a lot of people are probably totally unfamiliar with that because you just don't see that, you know, today. So can you tell us a little bit about how that process worked, with what a control was, and maybe speculate as to the reasons why we don't see such communication anymore?
Yeah, well, the idea of a spirit control was, you know, in mediumship, the idea is that you are bringing on the spirits of people that have died. But the spirit control from the very beginning was the idea that there were special spirits that will work with specific mediums to bring out communications. So it was like a master of ceremonies that helped other spirits to contact the medium and then produce messages through the medium, through writing or verbally or in any other way. But it was a spirit that was supposed to be helping in that process in a very, very active way. And, of course, ideas about the nature of that spirit control have changed over time. Started with the idea that they were actually what they were claimed to be, you know, actual spirits of the dead. But early on, and as psychology developed on other lines, a lot of people were skeptical of that idea and started arguing that spirit controls were the creation, you know, the medium's mind, and they really did not exist. You know, again, evaluations of those things have to be done on a case-by-case basis. There are many cases where you don't have a lot of evidence of the independent existence of that spirit control, but then there are other cases where it's the opposite. You can document historically that such a person either existed, and, you know, there are some data that you can get and be at least sure that someone with that name at a particular time period really existed.
Yeah.
Well, the whole concept, you know, has been very, very important in the study of mediumship, and a lot of the better studied mediums of the old days, mediums like Leonora Piper, Gladys Osborne Leonard, and many others, you know, they had very interesting and sometimes extremely colorful spirit controls that from the descriptions, you know, they really sounded like people, and they were very animated, and so it's a fascinating manifestation.
Yeah, and then you have some mediums. I know you've studied Eusebia Palladino, where, you know, that's interesting to me because from what I've read, she was an extraordinarily gifted medium and very evidential, but at the same time, sometimes resorted to cheating. So, I mean, why do you suppose, you know, credible mediums, you know, resort to deception?
Yes, well, I think there may be many explanations. One of them is that their abilities, you know, do not work all the time, and they have a lot of pressure to perform, and some of them, you know, may decide just to help the manifestations along. Having said that, I think there is also a very interesting argument that I think has some validity, the whole issue of unconscious fraud. And that was something that was discussed widely with Palladino. And that's the idea that, yes, some mediums trick, like Palladino will trickery of different sorts, but it was not really consciously done. Being in trance, you know, the medium was trying to produce a phenomena. She was sitting in a circle surrounded by a lot of people that wanted the phenomena, and she had the pressure of having to produce. And the idea that was developed with her, that was not completely original, but was developed around in the 1890s, was that they will imprint on her mind that she had the obligation to produce the phenomena. She, of course, wanted to comply because she liked to be useful. But at that particular moment, her being a physical medium, so production of physical effects, her organism could not produce the energy or the force that was behind those phenomena. And but the phenomena had to happen. There was that pressure. So instead of having some type of psychic energy being projected from her body to move a table, she will, in the trance, with even without her conscious intention, will just extend her arm and grab an object and throw it across the room. Because for her, being in trance, that was producing a phenomena. And the analysis that we're making is that that's not necessarily the same type of fraud that we see with someone that plans to commit fraud, plans to do it, but it's just a person trying to produce the phenomena in any way they can, thinking that they're doing the right thing.
Yeah, that's very interesting, you know, because I've observed that often with mental mediums today. You know, I mean, we've turned a lot of them into performers, you know, and they're human and they have this pressure. And when the information is not flowing, a lot of them have a tendency, whether consciously or unconsciously, to sort of help it along, you know. And I think that's one of the problems with mediumship today. So I guess it's not all that different from the way it used to be.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. And then there are many times that it's not an issue of helping it along. There is also the issue that sometimes the communications can be mixed or contaminated more with the actual mental content of the medium. That's an idea that you find from the early spiritualist literature, you know, from the 1850s here in the United States, where a lot of the writers that were firm believers in spirit communication will also caution their readers that sometimes the messages that will come were completely distorted by the emotions of the medium's thoughts, or the emotions of the thoughts of the sitters around the medium. So you could get out all kinds of information that was really not coming from the spirit world, but was contaminated by the medium or the sitters. And it's interesting how those ideas were very widely distributed in the early spiritualist literature, but seem sometimes to be forgotten. You know, early spiritualists were very much aware of the complexities of the process. That is an idea, something that I like to repeat, because some people like to present spiritualists as being very uncritical and not understanding a lot of the processes. And I think they were the first ones that really pointed out the complexity of the process and that you needed to be careful.
And actually last night I pulled out one of your papers that you wrote a number of years ago. And in the paper, you quoted John Edmonds, and I wrote down what it said. You put in a quote where Edmonds said, "I know of no mode of spiritual intercourse that is exempt from a moral taint. No kind of mediumship with a communication may not be affected by the mind of the instrument." So it's really hard to distinguish whether or not the medium can totally disassociate themselves from the information.
No, that's true. There was a lot of speculation about that, and sometimes it was very clear that the messages were distorted. And the thing is, you know, they also had a lot of other types of communications that were things that could clearly be checked. You know, they will get specific names and dates and things that, when checked out, in many of those cases, it was obvious that it was something much beyond the mind of the medium.
Right.
So they will emphasize on those. But it's true, you know, there is a lot of mix in these things, and that's an area that I think that we could use the ideas of Edmonds and many of the other earlier writers to conduct studies today about mediumship. It will be very interesting to document better all those communications that are contaminated by the man of the medium and try to trace the root of that contamination, what type of things come into play and why and in what moments. Some people argue that during in the old days, the trans mediums, you know, the trans is not a single entity or a single thing. There are many stages of trance, and it could be very deep trance or trance that is extremely light. And we know from psychology, you know, that there are different the different states of consciousness in which with hypnosis and many other conditions, we have different levels of access to subconscious material. So I think considering all those things put together, that will be a fascinating area of research today to document those things further. And I think the practical utility of that is the more we know about the problems, the more we can do to control for them and get better communications from mediums and messages that we may feel are kind of free of that contamination, if that's possible.
Yeah, that's an interesting concept. You know, when you talk about, you know, trance, light trance, heavy trance, I mean, sometimes I'll ask, you know, the mental mediums today if they would describe their process as going into a trance-like state. I mean, do you think would you describe, or is it more like going into a zone? Is that the same as saying going into a trance? I mean, it's some sort of altered state of consciousness that they're evidently in. So, I mean, would it be a mistake to call it a trance?
Yeah. I think that would be part of what is called a trance. The thing is that the word trance really has been used in a very, very flexible way. You know, people sometimes use it to mean even different things. And that's a problem, I think, that we have in a lot of research. Not to mention, you know, that also a lot of the current mediums do not seem to be trans mediums, at least not in the sense of the old mediums like Mrs. Piper and others. I think, you know, mediumship is valid in many different ways, and you can be a good medium without producing trans. But I think certainly there are many different alterations of consciousness. Just as in altered states of consciousness in general, you know, you can have very light in between and profound states of dissociation, of alteration. I think the same applies also to mediumship. In fact, there are some documentation of that with the mediumship of Piper and Palladino in the old days, in which they will basically try to make like a map of the way they went into trance, and many investigators noticed that there were different types of trances and sometimes perhaps even different stages. But that kind of stuff has not developed much, at least not scientifically. And I think that today, if we could find, you know, mediums that will produce trance, and I think, you know, they exist in this country and in many other places like Brazil and many other countries, we now have more means to study these alterations via physiological measurements and other ways, you know. And it's a question that, you know, we don't have a lot of people doing systematic studies of mediums. There are some out there, but we really need, I think, a lot more attention to those things.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, one of the problems from a research perspective is, as you mentioned, the trance mediums are few and far between. So finding the subjects that are willing to subject themselves to scientific inquiry is not an easy task, right?
No, that's true.
Yeah. Right, we're going to go to a break. When we come back, if you don't mind, I'd like to get into deathbed visions, because I know it's certainly not a new phenomenon, and it's been around for years. So we're going to go to a short break, and we're going to come back with Dr. Carlos Alvarado. Stay with us. We'll be back in a few.
Starseed Gems Studios in Cocoa, Florida fuses cremation ashes within art glass, making beautiful stones. The ashes are visible in the darkness and resemble a beautiful night sky. Darcy gems developed by the parents of a young man who passed away are set in hand-sculpted silver and gold settings. Prices start at $150. Visit www.starseedgems.com or call 321-632-7770. That's www.starseedgems.com or 321-632-7770. Perhaps you have heard that there is scientific evidence of an afterlife, but you are confused. Plan to attend a landmark convention in Durham, North Carolina, November 8th and 9th, and let's clear up that confusion. Let an esteemed group of scientists from prestigious universities and institutions show you the way. This will be a gathering of the top organizations that have been researching afterlife evidence for decades, all coming together for the first time. Whether you want to learn about reincarnation, mediumship, apparitions, deathbed visions, near-death experiences, or phone calls from the dead, this is the place to be. The weekend will also include demonstrations of spirit communication by Forever Family Foundation certified mediums. Click on the events page at our website, foreverfamilyfoundation.org, to learn more about the conference weekend and the many additional events before and after the conference. Or call 631-425-7707 for more information.
The American Association of Electronic Voice Phenomena has always been international and concerned with more than just EVP. To better serve the public, the AAEVP is now Association Transcommunication, or ATRANSC. Their new website is atransc.org, and their motto is Objective Evidence of Survival. The directors believe people should know that death is not dying, and what we learn now applies to what we will learn hereafter.
I would like to introduce you to the Forever Family Foundation, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to provide a forum where individuals and families who have suffered the loss of a loved one can turn for support, information, and hope. We believe in the continuity of the family, even though a member has left the physical world. The Forever Family Foundation is a joint effort of scientists, research mediums, and interested people who support the premise that life does not end with physical death. We wish to prove that the bond of the family cannot be broken even by death. We invite anyone who's trying to cope with the loss of a loved one to contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707. That's 631-425-7707, or you can find us on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
Welcome back to Signs of Life, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation.
If you're just tuning in, our guest tonight is Dr. Carlos Alvarado. Our sponsor is Starseed Gems, and they are the proud sponsors of the 8th Annual Original Afterlife Conference this year in Durham, North Carolina, November 8th and 9th. And you can find Starseed Gems on the web at starseedgems.com. If you are a business interested in advertising on our show, please contact us via email at radio@foreverfamilyfoundation.org or call the office at 631-425-7707. Before we get back to our show, I have a few foundation updates for you. Did you know that you can financially support the work of Forever Family Foundation, a 100% volunteer not-for-profit, without sending us a single pretty penny? When shopping on the Internet, think of us before you go to Amazon.com and instead go to ForeverFamilyFoundation.org and use the Amazon link to get to Amazon. Don't worry, there's a link on every page of our website, and if you add that one simple step to your shopping, a dollar percentage of everything that goes into your shopping cart will generate a donation from Amazon to us. And what if you don't shop on Amazon? That's not a problem. There's another way to be certain that almost all your website shopping produces a donation to Forever Family Foundation without you having to send us anything. Visit iGive.com. Sign up. It's free. Name Forever Family Foundation as the charity of your choice. And just like with Amazon, a portion of your spending results in a donation to Forever Family Foundation. Once you set it up, each time you shop on the internet, iGive.com will automatically send us a donation when you shop in one of their more than 1,400 online stores that you're probably already shopping in, like the Apple Store and Gap. How about J. Crew or Sony? So please take a few moments when you shop to show us that you care. And finally, plan to get yourself to Durham, North Carolina for the biggest and best afterlife conference ever on November 8th and 9th. It's a convention of the top organizations that have been dedicated to the investigation of life beyond this physical life. From November 6th through the 11th, we have loads of special things planned, including a day at the Rhine Research Center with a spoon bending party. So visit our website, foreverfamilyfoundation.org, and make your reservations now. This will be a big one, and you do not want to be left out of this wonderful, fabulous group of people. Back to you, Bob.
And we are proud that we have Dr. Carlos Alvarado with us. You can find out more information about Carlos's work on the azire.org. That's azire.org. And we're also happy that Carlos will be presenting at the conference that Fran just was telling you about. And his presentation is going to center around deathbed visions. So I guess, Carlos, deathbed visions, they're under-researched. They're so significant. The phenomenon still remains unknown to many people. So this might be a good time just to give us a little overview about what a deathbed vision is.
Yes, well, deathbed visions have traditionally kind of been defined as those experiences that people have when they're dying. You know, it's kind of very common to hear that someone that is dying all of a sudden raises themselves from bed and will say that they see spirits of their relatives that have died before, and they even hold a conversation with them. And soon after they die, not immediately, some of them can go for hours or even days, but there are some that die just immediately after having that experience. Sometimes they say that they see beautiful places. You know, you see their faces light up with joy, and they say that they see a very beautiful scene with a lot of green, like a forest or a heavenly, you know, environment. And there are many things like that are reported. And, you know, deathbed visions are kind of part of the study of apparitions in psychical research. Apparitions being, you know, things that people see particularly related to the dead or the dying. The apparitional experiences really are extremely rich and varied in content, and there are different types of apparitional experiences, you know, many that happen around death, after death, or even that predict death, you know, people that are seen before they die. And it's a fascinating field, but in the deathbed context is basically around, as the term says, deathbed, around the bed of someone that is dying at home or in a hospital. And they have all these phenomena. So from the early 19th century, you know, well, certainly it's a phenomenon that goes back to antiquity. That's the first thing to say. They are not modern by any way. They have always been with us. But they have been studied more systematically starting in the late 19th century and even more during the 20th century. And what researchers have tried to do is first find cases and then try to document the characteristics, get the account of the experience that the person, you know, is saying, what they actually saw, what they actually heard, and so forth. There had not been a lot of scientific studies of this phenomena. There has been a lot of writing and a lot of good discussions, but in terms of actually, you know, getting cases, documenting them well, and studying the relationship of different aspects of the cases, the research has been kind of limited. It's interesting that in recent times that whole context of deathbed phenomena is being expanded with the current interest in what is called now the shared death experiences, which is basically, you know, the traditional deathbed experience comes from the experience of the dying person. But the shared death experiences, which also have a long history going back, are basically the experiences of the people that are standing around the person that is dying, where that they also hear things, they also can see things, and that really expands the implications and the whole range of these experiences, because it makes the experience a more collective one, a more powerful one. And that's what we're starting to see now, a lot of more people paying attention to that kind of research. So you cannot separate the private deathbed experience of the dying person from the experience of the people around. I think it's part of the same phenomena. It's just that we are seeing the experience from different viewpoints.
Yeah, and it's important because the shared experience tends to dispel the notion that the phenomenon is caused by a dying brain or a hallucination. You know, where healthy people are witnessing the same thing. Yeah, so
exactly.
Well, what about, you know, as you mentioned, this is going back thousands of years. People have been reporting it, so there's not a lot of research, but there's, you know, tons of anecdotal, you know, evidence and eyewitness accounts. Why do you suppose that more people aren't aware of this? I mean, why is there this reluctance to talk about these experiences?
Yeah, I think that, first, the topic of death in general for a lot of people has been and still is kind of like a taboo topic, you know. It's one of these topics that a lot of people are afraid to talk about, and they consider it to be either too personal or too weird to be discussing it. I think we have always had a lot of these experiences around, but they are kept inside the history of the family, and a lot of people do not share these experiences because they're afraid that they will be labeled by their close friends or other relatives as being, you know, unbalanced or being uncritical, you know, believing too much on all these mystical things that are not valid in the mind of a lot of people. And I think that, you know, those things over time, they have been changing. I think we're in an era now. It's not that those things do not happen. They still happen and plenty. You know, there is a lot of resistance, but I think the doors have opened much more. We have been in, at least from the 1970s onward, you know, publicly the discussion of phenomena such as near-death experiences and other aspects of dealing with death, like dealing with grief and with loss, all those things have been discussed more openly, and I think society is becoming a little more open and used to have these topics out there. And I think as that happens more, a lot of these deathbed experiences that I think have been there all the time become okay, and it's okay to share the experiences more. Initially, people will share them only with someone that they believe is open to them. Like, you know, when I talk to people, I hear a lot of those experiences because, you know, I take them seriously. I will never laugh at someone, and I will, you know, I'll believe what they are telling me. So they feel that they can talk more openly because there are more forums to do that. There are more places to do that. And you see so many things in websites, on TV, and I think that's bringing, that has changed the whole environment, the whole social environment to these things, that it has become more acceptable to a lot of people. And I'm hoping that that will continue, you know, because that also helps those of us that want to do more systematic study of these experiences, the first things that you need is the cooperation of people that will come forward and say, this happened to me, or this happened in my family. And I will say it again, I think these things have always and are still very prevalent. They are all around us. Not only these things related to death, but all kinds of other psychic experiences, you know, precognitive dreams, all kinds of other ESP type of experience, many of which are less dramatic than the death-related one, but are still important and are still telling us something, I think, about human nature. There is more of an openness, I think, these days to share about those phenomena.
Yeah, absolutely, and I couldn't agree more, and I think we're making some progress, and the most important thing that could possibly happen is that people start sharing more and more, as you mentioned, because that will open up a world of possibilities. One of the things that I hate about our talks is that there is never, ever enough time, because we could go on and on for hours and hours. I wanted to get into your research with out-of-body experiences, but quickly, I know that in some of your talks, you discuss experiments that have been conducted at the time of death. We only have a couple of minutes, but can you give me an example of such an experiment that happens at the time of death?
Yeah, those are very rare, but people have basically tried to find out if they can take a photograph or measure in some physical way the whole idea that the spirit or soul is leaving the body at death. One example was the case of a French doctor called Hippolyte Baraduc. And he was very much into psychic phenomena, believing in psychic forces and all that. And he published in 1908 a very interesting small pamphlet in which he said that when his wife was dying, he started taking photographs of her systematically. And he was very much into detecting all these forces using photography. And later on, he found out that when he, developed the photographic plates, that they were all these unusual-looking globes of light that were on top of her body. They seemed like three separate globes that seemed to be emerging from her body. And, he has several sets of photos in which they, over a period of about 3 hours or so, they keep changing in shape. And later on they became, he stopped taking the photos, and he said that he had some experiences of telepathic contact with the spirit of his wife, and many other things happened. But that's just an example of someone that was trying to do some type of test at the very moment of death. As you can imagine, though, almost no one has done that, or if they have, they have not reported it, and it's understandable that people will not do those type of experiments, because most people are involved in great grief, and the only thing they're thinking is that they are losing their wife or their father or mother. So,
right.
I think it's normal that there are very few of these type of studies, but the whole idea is to try to do something that will measure what happens at that transition. Other people have tried to measure changes in weight.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, we're running out of time. The scholar that you have been listening to is Dr. Carlos Alvarado. You can find out more about his work by going to the website, theazire.org. Carlos, thanks so much for joining us, and we are anxiously awaiting seeing you again in North Carolina in November. So thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome. It has been my pleasure.
Have a good evening.
We now ask our listeners to please join us in our Healing Energy Circle prayer. May the universe create a channel of healing energy from our participating listeners, sending that energy to those who are in need of recovery of the physical body, spirit, and mind, as we visualize the healing light upon Donna Mello, Ann Hutchinson, Kimberly Saavedra, Rachel Skandarian, Jeanette Davias, Marian Pierzga, Julie Beischel, Barbara Patillo, David Haith, Rita Springer, Mark Theron, Steffi, Jean Lash, Tracy Lee Nash, Eddie Roll, Doug Berry, Philip McPhee, Tim Donahue, Tom Donahue, Barbara Russell, Wendy Lippo, Eileen Lafada, Patty Potter, Michael Tim, Lynn Austin, Glenna Irwin, Stanley Mullen, Tanya Cash, Andy O'Brien, Johnny Jackson, Henry Stark, David Mello, Richard, Andrea, Arthur and Bernice Goforth, and James Rafferty, Brian, Nina, and Karen. And now it's time for us to ask as one consciousness to give our energy of loving thought by praying like this: to love one another, to treat others as we would like to be treated, to forgive others and return love for hate, kindness for anger, to spread this feeling to everyone, to our fellow man, as well as the earth and its environment.
And remember that our loved ones are only a heartbeat away.
And science is going to prove it.
Good night, everyone.